The Lara Murphy Show, episode 31.
Welcome to The Lara Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Lara Murphy Show. I'm one half of your hosts, Bob Murphy. With me, as usual, is Carlos Lara. Carlos, how are things in Nashville?
Well, you know, it's that time of the year, Bob. Getting to the end. I'm telling you, it's you know, just trying to close all the books out and do all the kind of thing I guess all business owners have to do around this time. And
which is try to make it look like your business earned no net income whatsoever.
Yeah, trying to see how you can keep from paying Uncle Sam so much money. And it's affecting my mood, you know. I don't have much time to get into the Christmas spirits, but anyway, I'm making it.
Okay, that's good enough. You put up the Christmas lights and pull down your net income. That's what happens in December. Folks, before we jump into the content for this episode, let me make an announcement. So on Saturday, February 11th, 2017, Carlos and I, as well as Nelson Nash and David Stearns, are going to be in Birmingham, Alabama, putting on an IBC seminar for the general public. And so this is going to be a workshop that's, what is it, like 4 hours long? Is that about right, Carlos?
Approximately, yes.
Yeah, so it's a seminar that we put on for the general public. So for people, whether you've seen anything about IBC at all, or you could be a complete novice, and that's fine, but we also just go through the whole spectrum of why average households and business owners should learn about IBC and the benefits of it. And again, it's intended for the general public. So if you're interested in that and think you'll be in the area, just look at the show notes page again. This is episode 31, and you'll have a link there for the information if you want to attend the event. Again, that's going to be Saturday, February 11th, 2017 in Birmingham, Alabama. So now as we turn to the topic for today, Carlos had sent me an interesting chart he got from Bloomberg. So Carlos, why don't I turn the mic over to you and have you explain to the listeners exactly what you're looking at and what we're going to be talking about.
Okay, well, I'm assuming, of course, that you'll post this on the website so our listeners can also view the chart. I don't know, it caught my attention, Bob, because it's really covering the entire year, 2016. And what it's tracking is, you know, the S&P 500 and the Dow, and how it has risen to such a high peak, you know, coming here at the end of the year. But the way the chart is laid out, it just shows where we saw some real dips, you know, obviously in the stock market. And it also shows the two great events of this year, which is the Brexit vote that happened back in June. And then, of course, with the other one, the election of Donald Trump as the president of the United States in November 8th, I guess it was. And so, I don't know, I thought we might take this chart and just kind of walk through some of the things that you and I are seeing as the year has progressed, because we've been on the podcast, we've been talking about these events as they have happened at the time they happen. And so I thought we might, you know, look at this and kind of review the year and talk about some of the highlights again very quickly. And so that's why I sent it to you, thinking this would make a good podcast. And that's the reason.
Okay, great. So why don't we jump right in then? And yeah, you're right. We'll definitely post this at the show notes page for episode 31 of the Lara Murphy Show. So yeah, why don't we get right to it then? Do you want to open up?
Yeah, I'll go ahead. Well, obviously, as we can see, is that we see the first, you know, major drop in the stock market occurred earlier this year in February. And And when we investigated it at the time, if you remember, it was basically bank stocks that really took everything down. And what you and I were saying was the cause of a lot of that, being it centered on bank stocks, was because of the events that were going on in Europe at the time, and in particularly with Deutsche Bank, which we talked about is five times larger than Lehman Brothers, and it was in trouble, and it had just posted a 2015 major loss, somewhere around $7.3 billion in losses. And obviously this got out to everybody and everybody started panicking. And another event that happened there is that the COCOs, the contingent capital bonds that Deutsche Bank was holding, they took a major hit in February, because the stock on Deutsche Bank, once the announcement was made, went into a free fall. I think it was trading somewhere around 21 euros a share, dropped all the way down to 13, in a blink of an eye. And so that situation going on with Deutsche Bank, it set off the same kind of situation with a lot of the other European banks in the area. They started having the same difficulty with those contingent capital bonds. And it filtered all the way into Italy, where there's so many banks that are in such dire straits. And so that whole situation, what was going on in Europe, impacted the stock market in that way. So in February, we saw this huge drop in the stock market. And that's what you see, the very first thing you see when you look at the chart.
Well, the other thing that I remember, because also if we're looking at the chart, you can see the stocks were actually falling in January also. Then they bounced up and then plummeted in February. And I remember another thing that was going on is, remember that in December of 2015 is when the Feds first started raising rates, very gingerly, of course. And that tied in well. So this chart that I've been using like crazy in the last several years, and anything related to the Laura Murphy output, has been tracking the S&P 500 against the monetary base, or sometimes the total assets held by the Federal Reserve. And so even though the Fed did not start selling assets last year when they hiked rates for the first time, the monetary base, the way they measure it, did start going down. And that was because they were doing repos, or reverse repos, I guess. And that's the way that the Fed is. And also they raised how much they're paying banks to keep money parked at the Fed. But it's through these various tools, not the conventional one of selling off assets and sucking reserves out of the system, that the Fed started raising rates. And that's what they're going to continue doing, at least for the foreseeable future. When they raise rates, they're not selling off mortgage-backed securities or treasuries. And so just the way they calculate it, if they do those reverse repos, it briefly sucks reserves out of the system. And that's considered to be a drop in the monetary base. And so, using that metric, it was showing that, the monetary base is dipping down. And so then if the S&P 500 has been tracking that, I was not surprised that in January last year that the stock market was falling pretty sharply, or at least the U.S. market. So there's those things going on as well. And that's partly relevant because we're facing that same situation this time around. The Fed, as we record this, the Fed's getting ready to meet in a few days, and it's widely expected they're going to announce another modest rate hike. And so, of course, we'll keep tabs on that and keep you guys informed, listeners of the Laura Murphy Show, but it would not surprise me if we see a similar pattern play out where they're technically sucking more reserves out of the system, which has the same economic effect as if they sold off assets. And that's going to strain markets, and that's how they're going to partly push up interest rates, and we'll see if that has an effect on the stock market.
Right, and then of course, as you're looking at this particular chart, you begin to see that leading up to June, when we saw the Brexit vote come in, but leading up to that, it's very obvious on the chart that the stock market now is rising, steadily rising, going up. I mean, there's a few little bumps in there, but it's on the rise. And all this has been, all this is going on, you know, with this prolonged low interest rate environment that's been going on now for several years. And obviously negative interest rates, you know, came in into play as well. And seems that a lot of the things that we were talking about were, you know, helicopter money. We were talking about, you know, the war on cash and, you know, all these kinds of things that that were happening in this very low interest rate environment. Everybody was just getting used to it, and everybody had their eye on what the Fed was going to do with interest rates. And, you know, Janet Yellen would take us only so far, but not actually tell us. and seems like everybody had to make a guess of some sort of what was going to happen to interest rates. And so I guess there was this feeling that interest rates were just going to remain low. And so this is what you clearly see in the reaction of the stock market to all of this, is that it keeps going up all the way up until we get up to June. And then, of course, the surprise of the Brexit vote was a dramatic event, and it changed things. And you want to talk about that, Bob? What was that? What were the major changes of that particular vote and what it did to the markets?
Well, at least in the short term, I mean, it caused a lot of panic. You know, so again, it was unexpected. It was sort of like with the Trump election that the polls are so forth. Well, I don't know what the polls showed, but certainly the people who were building forecasts based on polling data were thinking it was a foregone conclusion that Brexit was going to fail and that they were, you know, UK was going to stay in the Eurozone. But that's not what happened. So that surprised a lot of people. And then a lot of people in the markets thought, you know, they didn't know what it was going to signify. I think that's part of the issue, was just there's a lot of uncertainty. And so traditionally, what do people do when they're uncertain? They start dumping stocks and they get into fixed income, especially for bonds that are considered to be very safe. So I think that's what happened. I mean, because there was all sorts of uncertainty about, well, what does this mean? Are they going to still be in the common market? Are there going to be, you know, huge retaliatory tariffs? Like, are the European nations going to really punish the British people to kind of send a signal to everybody else? Like, hey, don't you think about leaving, because look what's going to happen to you. So there was all sorts of issues like that. And then, I mean, at this point, that's sort of old news that now things have calmed down and people are like, well, you know, actually, maybe this wasn't such a bad deal after all. But initially, there was that panic and people really didn't know what was going to happen.
Right. And I think what it left everybody in the world, you know, recognizing maybe for the first time that there was this movement toward populism, you know, and maybe it wasn't as sharp as a repudiation of globalization at that point. But certainly with the, you know, the Brexit vote, other countries started thinking maybe this was time to go ahead and leave the Euro Union. They haven't liked it. They've been kind of going back and forth with it. You know, you got all these countries that have different backgrounds, different histories, and they're all having to use the same currency. So, you know, it was one of those things where it left the rest of the Eurozone sort of wondering, you know, are we going to lose more countries? And I think that was one of the major after effects of all of that. You know, people just wondering exactly what was going to happen there. But yet, again, the stock market seems to be clipping along okay. The chart doesn't show it's as steep of a rise, kind of leveling off after Brexit. And then, of course, as we move into November, the chart clearly shows that there was this major drop in markets, you know, right before the announcement of who actually won. Or I take it back, actually, when there was word that Trump had won, the markets reacted, you know, pretty violently in the negative, and then seemed like they straightened right out pretty quickly. And there was this feeling that there was going to be inflation going forward. And all of a sudden, we see the stock market really start to take off again. And as we near the end of the year, I mean, it's at an all-time high. So that's what this chart shows. It's an interesting a look at the year and what has happened, you know, in view of the stock market with these events that have taken place.
Right. My recollection, it's hard to see on this chart that's, you know, big enough to show the whole year. But in terms of the election, I think what happened was the actual day of the election, as, you know, the results were coming in. So by the time people realized, oh, my gosh, Donald Trump might win this thing, because, you know, that, of course, had been completely unexpected by most people. At that point, the U.S. markets were closed. And so so you had to look like markets overseas, and they started dropping heavily. And even like Dow futures contracts were also, you know, signifying a sharp drop. And so a lot of people were guessing that as soon as the markets opened in the morning, the day after the election, now the people realize, oh, my gosh, we got President-elect Trump. People, I was seeing figures saying the markets were going to open down anywhere from 5 to 10%. And then they didn't. Like you said, they actually shot up. You know, the markets appreciated pretty strongly the next few weeks after Trump won. And so I don't have, you know, it's not like a real scientific explanation or anything, but my gut feel is just that it was the uncertainty and the shock. And because remember, the media had pointed Trump as this madman. And so I think a lot of people, just their initial reaction when they had been so sure that Hillary Clinton, yeah, we don't like her policy. She's going to raise taxes and have more regulation and have maybe even price controls on pharmaceuticals. But at least, you know, she's been in the club for decades and she's not going to do something crazy. I think that was the mentality. And then all of a sudden Trump's coming in and everyone's like, oh my gosh, what is this nut job going to do? Like, is he just going to start launching nuclear weapons or just say we're going to stop making payments on treasury bonds? Who knows? And then I think they calmed down. You know, they got a good night's sleep. And then I think they realized by the next day, well, you know, maybe he was just saying that stuff to get elected. You know, he's been in business for decades and, you know, maybe he was just, you know, putting on a show to get elected. And if you think about it, he was promising large tax cuts and rolling back regulations on the energy sector. And, you know, okay. So that's what I think happened, is they kind of just freaked out. Everyone started selling in a panic, and then they kind of calmed down and realized, you know, actually maybe this is good in terms of economic growth. Maybe they don't like, you know, his social policies or things like that. Well, okay, so I think that's a good summary of what, where we are, and it is
a good summary, and that's why I sent you this chart, Bob. You know, and again, I'm sure you'll post it to the website so that our listeners can hear it. But one of the things that I did want to introduce here, Bob, is that I saw an interesting article where one of the, you know, the chief investment strategists for Merrill Lynch and Bank of America, you know, he was saying that the greatest event that happened in this year really was in the bond market. And it wasn't breakfast. It wasn't the election of Donald Trump. He was saying it's what's happened with bonds. And the article, you know, caught my attention and started thinking about that particular part of it. And it's true, Bob, that while we're looking at a chart here that's dealing and tracking the stock market, we have seen a major change in the bond market. And in particular, what we have seen, and I think it's worth talking about, is that without the central bank or the Fed actually directly manipulating interest rates to go up, the markets themselves have pushed the yields on bonds up, and they've pushed them out of the below zero range, the negative range, past zero, and they're up higher now. And so that is a major event that has that's happened. And there was a huge sell-off, of course, that we saw happen with bonds. But I wonder if you could address that piece, Bob. I think we need to talk about what has happened to the bond market, especially, you know, with these two major events, Brexit and the Donald Trump election.
Okay, sure. So I think what happened was after the Brexit vote, there was a plunge in bond yields. Okay, so yield means like the interest rate you're earning on your money when you buy a bond. And so bond yields dropped after the Brexit vote, so it kind of goes hand in hand with the falling stock market. And so what was happening is, and this is the thing, maybe we can walk through the mechanics of this, but I think people know the general rule of thumb that if bond yields go one way, then that means the bond prices go the other way. So what was happening in the immediate wake of the Brexit vote was people were dumping stocks and switching over to bonds because bonds are, you know, considered safer. Like if you're uncertain and you want to lock in your money, you're not looking for a big return, but you just want to make sure your money's there. You go into what's called fixed income or, you know, bonds. And so I think that's what happened. So that was the increased demand to hold bonds was pushing up the price of bonds, and that means the yield was going down. Or another way of looking at it was that investors were willing to tolerate even lower yields, even in Europe, where they were literally negative. They were being even more negative just because they were so panicked and didn't know where to park their money. And so they were even willing to tolerate slightly losing their money over time just so that the principal would roughly still be there. And then the opposites happened since the election of Trump, where bond yields are going up, meaning people are dumping bonds. And just to give you an example of the magnitude, so if we're looking at U.S. Treasuries, right before the election, the 10-year Treasury yield was about like 1.82. That's November 4th. That's the quote I'm seeing. And then now it's jumped up to about 2.37. All right. So, you know, that's a, you know, give or take, you know, about 0.5 percentage point jump. I'm just rounding there. So that's a pretty big move, especially considering how low the yields were in absolute terms. And so that, you know, we can decompose that. Some of it is just due, there's two main reasons for that. So in other words, why is it that yields all over the place, but the ones I just quoted there were the movements in the 10-year Treasury. Why did it go from about 1.8 to about 2.4, let's say, so more closer to a 0.6% move? Why did it do that? Well, it's partly because increased inflation expectations, but also increased expectations of real economic growth. Okay, so rightly or wrongly, investors think the economy is going to grow more now after Donald Trump won and they started hearing the kind of people he was picking and they saw the supply side advisors he had around him. And so that's partly why stocks went up, right? And so then by the same token, if now you think there's going to be higher real growth, well, then you're going to want to get those, you know, returns locked into your bonds also. And at the same time, here I think they're just wrong, but people have a Keynesian mindset and they associate a stronger economy with higher price inflation. So like I said, I think that's actually a mistake, but I think it's such a widely held mistake that it shows up in market movements. And so now they think, oh, the economy is going to grow more. So that means we're going to have stronger demand and higher pressure on prices. And so in addition to thinking, you know, real growth is going to be higher, they also think the amount of price inflation going forward is going to be higher. And so you build that into to what your nominal bond yield return needs to be. So I think it were those two things. Me just eyeballing the chart, because you can kind of back it out by looking at the TIPS yields versus the nominal, you know, regular Treasury yields. It looks to me like maybe, I don't know, a third of the increase was just due to the increase in inflation expectations, but the other two thirds were people really do think the economy is going to be, you know, growing more quickly because of Trump's election.
Right. And that you pretty much mirrored exactly what this particular strategist was saying, actually. He was pointing specifically to July when the yield, you know, on bonds hit their all-time low. And that was about a month after Brexit. But since then, the yields on bonds have been going up. And then, of course, when we get to the Trump situation, there was this massive sell-off of bonds. I wanted to say it was like $1 trillion worth of bonds sold off. And then all of a sudden, the yields now have moved up so much that it's almost not a big issue that, you know, that the central banks now decide to move interest rates up. So it's like the markets actually did the raising rather than the central banks doing it. And that's an interesting piece, you know, to recognize. And I guess what you're saying and what this particular strategist was saying is that in July, you know, it in essence closed the books on the bond bull market, and so now everybody's thinking that, you know, we're heading toward an inflationary period and a period of higher interest rates. Now, he does say that it reminded him of a period back in the 1980s that was very similar. He said, but what he noticed about it, that there was a lot of volatility during that time, and a lot of overshooting and a lot of undershooting, just simply because everybody's trying to get a handle on what really is going to happen. But that, to me, is an important piece, that along with what we saw happen and are seeing happen in the stock market, we can't leave the bond market out of it, because there's been some major changes there as well.
Yeah. Is it worth me just briefly going through? I know you had mentioned before the episode that some people might not fully get, you know, how can it be that I'm like bonds that are already issued? What does it mean to say that the yield changes on them?
I think you should, because here we are. We're talking about as though everybody listening actually knows how bonds work. But I think if you just kind of re-explain, you know, what's going on, it might help everybody sort of piece together what we are saying.
Okay, sure. So let's say, you know, it's bonds are originally yielding 3%, and you go into the market and you buy a freshly issued bond from a company or, you know, from a government. And so you give up over a certain amount of money, let's say you give $1,000, and then you get a bond and it promises to pay you back your $1,000 upon maturity. And then all along the way, you're going to get regular cash payments, you know, and so they're fixed. That's why they're called fixed income assets. The amount of dollars you get is not dependent on the economic circumstances or whatever. It's just saying, no, on these dates, these are how many dollars you're getting paid. And so that's like interest on your $1,000 investment. And so when you originally buy the thing, if the face value and such is supposed to yield 3%, then that means you're going to get paid such that, you know, the interest you're earning on your money works out to 3% of your $1,000 investment. But now you're holding the thing, and then all of a sudden interest rates change and they go up to 5%. So what happens is, you know, the company or the government that issued your bond, they're still sending the same cash payments. But now if you try to sell that bond to somebody else, he's not going to give you the $1,000 for it or whatever, you know, the balance would be, because, you know, he could earn 5% on his money by buying a new bond in the 5% interest rate environment. And so what has to happen is the price of your bond needs to drop so that now someone who spends a lower amount of money up front getting those same cash flows and then getting paid $1,000 upon maturity, when you run the numbers, now that person's earning effectively 5% return on that investment. And so that's the sense in which if you're holding a bond that's already been issued and interest rates go up, the market value of your bond, if you wanted to just sell it right now for cash and be done with it, the price you're going to fetch, you know, goes down, because it has to make it so that new investors coming in earn that new higher rate of return. Because the point is, people could, if interest rates go up, then that means new bonds issued at that higher yield, people could just put their money in that instrument. So if you're selling an old bond, a used bond, if you will, on the secondary market, then the price you're able to fetch has to be such that people still earn that higher rate of return. So if the face value of your bond doesn't reflect that, if that's not like the coupon yield, then the actual market price has to be lower to make it, you know, equilibrate. So that's the idea. And of course, the opposite's true. If interest rates go down, then the market price of existing bonds goes up.
Yeah, and that's a good explanation that I think needs to be said, Bob. You know, for me, the keys are, if you have a bond, the interest rate it pays is fixed to that bond. But of course, if you change the principal amount and it is lower when you buy it, that's going to automatically make you net out a higher interest rate. So that's how these interest rates are rising. That's the manner in which it's happening. So that's a good explanation. Bob, you know, I know we're getting to the end of this thing, podcast the time, but I wanted to throw out another thing I spotted that also caught my attention. And it was a Wall Street Journal article in which they were saying that China is hiding $3 trillion in loans by calling them investment receivables. And so it's a way of sort of cooking the books in such a way that by calling them investment receivables, they don't have to come up with as much reserves, you know, to back up those loans. So it's sort of a balance sheet maneuver and terminology. And that procedure has been rampant among most all of the banks in China. And so at this point, there's $3 trillion in bank loans out there that are hidden. And they're hiding them by calling them investment receivables. And of course, it makes them very risky because there's no reserves to prop them if something goes wrong. It makes the banks create profits. And of course, when you look at the banks in China, according to this article, it said they're running at 20% rate above, you know, in their profits. But that the reason that they've hooked on to this idea, and it's been going on for a while, since around, I think it said 2013, but it's a way to keep the credit spigot, you know, open to support the slowing down of China's economy. That's the main reason that it's being done. So in essence, these are like hidden credit risk on the whole, you know, commercial banking sector in China. And that if you back the numbers, you know, out, that amount of loans on the books would require the banks to come up with like 200 and something billion dollars in reserves. So by not having to come up with that amount of reserve, you know, these loans are very risky loans. You know, they can really cause a real problem with those banks if they have a real, you know, systemic risk problem that would occur there. And the article is alluding to the fact that in China, the banks feel pretty secure that, you know, Beijing will come in and bail them out if they get into trouble. And so that their only risk here is sovereign risk. So it's an article that really caught my attention, because if it's true, and I'm assuming that it is, that's a major problem that could really, I mean, at first, you know, you got the problem with the European banks, and we've talked a lot about those, but you put China into the picture, and that don't look too good.
Yeah, it really is. You're right. We focused more on Europe so far, and much of what we've done, and you in particular, and your articles in the Laura Murphy report, and none of that has been fixed. We should mention. I mean, Italy's banks are still a basket case, and the fact that Trump wins an election doesn't really alter that fact. And you're right. I've seen for several years now lots of people familiar with the dangers of loose credit and the possibilities of blowing up asset bubbles and things like that. And they've been warning that China is in a similar situation as the Western countries, that they also have been, pumping in credit and blowing up asset bubbles and things like that. So I'm not fully on top of the Chinese data, so I personally have not waded into that discussion. But from the cursory things that I've read, it does look like they might have a situation over there analogous to our own.
Yeah, and I think it's making me want to go there and try to look at that a little deeper, because if you wind up with a China-Europe crisis, that could be a major problem just for the whole, you know, the whole world. The article's actually saying that what they're really trying to do is prop up their currency. That's what it really looks like, you know, that and the apparently the central banks, I guess, are aware of it. They don't want Chinese people, you know, catching wind of all of this and trying to take money out of China, you know, cashing in everything there and maybe investing outside the country. So these are some things that are happening there that it's worth, you know, investigating further. But the world continues to be a very volatile place. This is not a, obviously not saying that this could blow over, and it could, but I was really struck by that and seeing that that's a potential problem.
Well, yeah, just to remind people too, remember it was in October 1st, I believe, of 2016. So, you know, this year, just earlier in October, that the IMF formally added the Chinese currency to the basket of what they call special drawing rights, or SDR, official reserve currencies.
That's right. Uh-huh.
And I think part of the issue there was, you know, in order to qualify and to smooth things over with the IMF to get accepted into the big boys club, they kind of had to show that they weren't as interventionist and that, you know, it was more like market forces determining the value of their currency. So there was issues related to that also. And even the chart that we're going to post, the one you sent me from Bloomberg, Carlos, if you remember, let's look back at it. They, you remember, it's got a circle there for what happened in January and February, and says China-led equity route.
Right.
Back in early 2016. And I think that also was over concerns about, you know, what the Chinese were doing. And it was various measures that some thought were, you know, what they were trying to do to prop up their currency, or at least to change the value of their currency. Because I remember at the time people were saying stuff that seemed to contradict each other. So without me taking a stand one way or the other, what they were trying to do, but for sure it had to do with them trying to transition to get their currency to be accepted as one of these so-called reserve currencies. Last thing I'll mention, Carlos, and you're right, we are over time at this point, but I did like your remarks earlier about how the market's moving these interest rates and it's not central banks. And remember, everybody, in the grand scheme, you know, global markets are deep and no central bank is omnipotent. And so even the Federal Reserve, ultimately, if people lose faith in the dollar, you know, the Fed has no power beyond that, right? So when we say things loosely that, like, oh yeah, the Fed's raising rates, I mean, strictly speaking, it's still a market-determined interest rate. What it just means is the Fed has the power to manipulate the quantity of reserves in the system. And then when commercial banks make loans to each other with those reserves, you know, the Fed can indirectly raise or lower the price by buying or selling assets and changing how many reserves are in the system. So ultimately, these prices are determined by buyers and sellers out in the market. It's not that the Fed comes out and, you know, has a price control the way that, you know, New York City apartment rents really are in some neighborhoods determined by political fiat. Here, it's a subtler process, but I think you're exactly right, Carlos, that here it was, you know, people just changing their expectations and selling bonds, and that's what pushed up the price, pushed up interest rates, and that I think that will put pressure on the Fed and other central banks to let interest rates rise and sort of, you know, endorse what the markets had been doing on their own.
Well, right. That's true. So I know that your recent article in the Laura Murphy Report said that Trump can't stop the crash from happening. I thought that was a gripping title. I would just like to close this podcast by saying that, you know, when people are asking us, you know, where's the crisis going to start? And I think the thing that we could say is that anytime you have a big pile of debt that can't be paid back, the crisis is not too far around the corner. And when we start reading now, China's starting to cook the books to hide how much debt they got. You know, we're getting close.
Yeah. So as Carlos alluded to in the November issue of the Laura Murphy Report? Yeah, I have an article saying that Trump, even though his policies, I'm somewhat optimistic that his economic policies actually will be better than a lot of people were thinking. Nonetheless, you know, the analysis Carlson and I have been putting out for several years at this point, saying the Fed's blown up this artificial bubble and it's coming crashing down. We don't know exactly when, but get ready for it. We still stand behind that, you know, Trump, even if he has good policies, and that remains to be seen, cannot undo the malinvestments that have been made for these last 8 years now because of artificially low interest rates and cheap credit that the Fed and other central banks have been pumping into the markets. Okay, well, we are out of time at this point. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Just a reminder, look at the show notes page for this, episode 31, to see the information if you're going to be in the Birmingham area, or even if you're not going to be and you want to put yourself there, because on Saturday, February 11th of 2017, Carlos Nelson Nash and I, as well as David Stearns, are going to be putting on, again, the IBC seminar for the general public. So if you've never been to one of those, you'll definitely want to check that out. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.